It was never really about the recognition. It was always, from the time I was young, really about the desire to touch people's lives in ways that would matter, to try to do potentially transformational things that could make a difference in what we think or what we know, in how we act, and in how our actions affect others.
That was Dr. Judith Rodin, former president of the Rockefeller Foundation and former president of the University of Pennsylvania. She's talking about the purpose that runs through her life, and the word transformational is key, because positive transformation is the very essence of Judith Rodin. I'm Elaine Verveer, and this is Seneca's 100 Women to Hear. We are bringing you 100 of the world's most inspiring and history-making women you need to hear. Judith Rodin has been on the cutting edge of so much positive change that it's hard to keep track. She was a pioneer in the field of behavioral medicine. She became the first woman to lead an Ivy League university when she was named president of Penn, and she was the first woman president of the renowned Rockefeller Foundation, making it a change agent for issues like planetary health, more sustainable agriculture, and more resilient cities. Dr. Rodin has also transformed our perspective on finance. She showed us how impact investing can be a force both for good and for company growth, a win-win to bring about a better world. Listen and learn why Dr. Judith Rodin is one of Seneca's 100 women to hear. I'm so thrilled to be speaking today with Dr. Judith Rodin, a woman of many firsts, a true game changer. Judith, I'm really excited to be with you today. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You were the first woman to be president of the University of Pennsylvania. You were the first woman president of the prestigious Rockefeller Foundation. You served on a White House commission. You've been honored by everyone from the UN to the American Psychological Association. And you've transformed every entity you've touched. And I feel I can say that from firsthand knowledge in many ways. How would you describe the common thread or mission in all that you've done? And perhaps even what you've been trying to achieve in the process?
Milan, thank you so much for having me and including me among this extraordinary group of women, and for all of your efforts to have those of us who have achieved and have accomplished be mentors and role models for the generations that are coming. I would say that the firsts have been extraordinary. The various honors have been gratifying. I loved being the first woman president of an Ivy League university because it gave me such a great platform from which to mentor other women. And I would say I'm self-aware enough to know how driven and how deeply goal-oriented I am. But it was never really about the recognition. It was always, from the time I was young, really about the desire to touch people's lives in ways that would matter, to try to do potentially transformational things that could make a difference in what we think or what we know, in how we act, and in how our actions affect others. And maybe a few examples would be useful here. From the first sort of leadership role I had, which was as an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania, I was president of the Women's Student Government. And it was an extraordinarily heady time. We were working on civil rights issues. It was the beginning of all the protests around the Vietnam War. And there were two separate student governments, the men's and the women's. And it seemed to me such a foolish anomaly, particularly at a time when the women were really leading on the more profound and important issues. And so I convinced the president of the men's student government that we should merge, which we did. And then I became president of the Penn student government. And it was an amazing time. We did extraordinary things. But I showed them a woman leader in action. When I got to Yale, We worked in ways that were really trying to create a new field. And with some colleagues at Yale and some colleagues at Harvard, we actually created new fields called behavioral medicine and health psychology. And we were motivated to do this, to forge new fields, to create new directions, because we wanted psychology and physiology to focus together on mind-body connections. And we also wanted our scientific disciplines to move more fluidly from theory to practice, because we didn't just want to publish articles. We really wanted to make a difference in practice that would help people's health and longevity. And maybe just two more quick ones. When I was at Penn, I led with my colleagues many important initiatives with regard to the more traditional roles of a university and a university president. But we also transformed a very deeply disadvantaged neighborhood on our doorstep, and we brought millions of dollars to that transformation, affecting housing, affecting economic development and job creation. We built public schools. We worked on a variety of issues that really would benefit that community. And we did it together. We didn't do it for the community. We did it with the community. It became an award-winning global model. But it was a very unusual thing, I think, for a university president to be focused on in such a significant and potentially transformational way, although many other universities also engaged in efforts following what we did. And then, of course, at Rockefeller, which you know best, we worked so hard to create and partner with many different sectors that often weren't thought of as working well together because we wanted to implement world-changing initiatives. And we really saw and understood that that would require systems change and that partnership could mean something different in the 21st century. It didn't mean let's just pool our money. That partnership meant really a strategic evaluation of what each sector did well or what would need to do actually to change. And then partner by having a multiplicative effect by each working on a different piece of the system that would then lead to transformation. So in all of these, I really tried to touch people's lives differently than what I had seen happening in other ways or in potentially that which other people were doing at the time.
I love those examples. And, you know, they really are emblematic of the way that you have brought about change. You know, I must say personally that whenever I'm at Penn, I stand in the neighborhood and think of how much it was transformed thanks to your leadership when you were president. And it has a lasting impact. And I know that's what you've always tried to do. But you mentioned that certainly you've had drive and you've been goal oriented. And I wonder where this comes from in Judith Rodin. Was it part of your growing up? Were there experiences that you can recall to this day that were formative in some way?
It was definitely part of my growing up. So I had a wonderful family, a pretty middle class family growing up in West Philadelphia, actually quite close to the university I would come to lead, but never obviously thinking that that was what would happen. But a wonderful family and very, very close-knit. My father, I think, made me driven because if I got a 97, he would ask me what happened to the other 3 points. And it didn't make me anxious. It really made me motivated in ways. I think I was so young that I didn't realize that was pressure. I thought it was pretty cool and pretty interesting. I think the other family differentiation for me is that we lived in row houses with a cement backyard dividing us between our row of houses and the next street. And my grandparents lived right across from us in that cement backyard. So every day when I went to school, starting in elementary school, I would walk out of my back door and I would walk into my grandparents' back door and be with them. And my grandfather was extremely learned and was studying when I walked in the morning and before he went to work. And the values of learning, of caring so much about education, about caring about tradition, I think really came so much from that family experience and maybe that sort of geographic anomaly. And then I would say the final thing, and this was extraordinarily important in my formation. I came home in seventh or eighth grade. I had gone to middle school in seventh grade. And I said proudly to my parents, Johnny, whoever was the putative boyfriend of the moment, told me that he likes me in spite of the fact that I'm smart. And my parents were so horrified and so shocked. And so luckily, after that, they sent me to Philadelphia High School for Girls, which was an all-women's school, a public school, which was quite extraordinary. We were all smart. We were all fierce and competitive. And these were very critical and formative years from ninth to 12th grade. And I always attribute so much of who I am and the motivation and the drive and the confidence that I have to having gone to Girls High during that time. It was so critically important.
That's really interesting because others who have had a comparable experience in high school have said the same thing, other women who had the opportunity.
You know, it was so funny, Milan, because I in freshman year at Penn, I placed out of some of the freshman courses. And so I was in an English course, a Shakespeare course, in the first few weeks of the first semester of my freshman year. And a young man in the class spoke up. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, boys are smart too. And it was, I really hadn't realized that for 4 years, I don't think.
Yeah, I remember Melinda Gates telling me because she had a comparable experience in high school. And she said, you know, nobody ever told us we couldn't do science. And so you do graduate with that confidence of your skill set, certainly.
Right.
You had mentioned the Rockefeller Foundation. And when you did, you talked about these extraordinary partnerships you were able to forge. And you were there for over a decade. But you really brought about a lot of change in some of the biggest issues that you took on. Can you talk a little bit about that?
We began, as I would approach anything, being a trained scientist. We consulted experts and we analyzed and debated the world's thorniest problems as they were occurring at the turn of this century. I started in 2005, a new century had begun. And we asked ourselves and we asked global experts, what were the biggest thorniest problems that the world was really confronting. But importantly, after that analysis, we asked ourselves, what were our sweet spots based on our DNA, our own history, our expertise, our convening authority, which was enormous based on all of the work of my predecessors. And importantly, our global roots. The Rockefeller Foundation is America's first global foundation. And actually, until the Marshall Plan, we were giving more foreign aid than the U.S. government.
Really?
So, yeah. So until the end of the Second World War. So the global footprint of the Rockefeller Foundation, its impact, we brought Western medicine to China. And indeed, when we celebrated our centennial in 2013, the Chinese government asked us to have the celebration in the Great Hall of the People because they wanted to be part of that celebration, saying thank you to Rockefeller for bringing Western medicine. And we heard that story over and over and over again all over the world. So we wanted to use that tradition, that DNA, which was also from its earliest roots, what John D. Rockefeller called scientific philanthropy, what I call smart risk-taking, that we take risks, we learn, we change, we take new directions based on what we're learning. And I think that's especially critical for philanthropy because I believed it should be used as America's risk capital because American philanthropy is funded with tax-credited dollars. And so who other than a philanthropy should be taking those smart risks? As I mentioned earlier, I emphasize partnership, which I do think is overlooked as a critical form of leadership in the 21st century. But we thought it was critical to really change entire systems, not just create and take small incremental steps. And because I think we took that kind of approach in everything we did, we were able to create entirely new fields like resilience, like impact investing. And we defined new approaches that really impacted how others saw the world. So we framed the concept of planetary health as we tried to look at the interaction of biodiversity and ecosystem health, climate change, and human health. And putting those all together led to many transformational initiatives. We worked with the UN, and in doing so, we got 147 nations to agree to some form, a basic form, if you will, in every country of universal health coverage. With our colleagues at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we helped to transform African agriculture, and the impact today is enormous, particularly on women, because women are the smallholder farmers in Africa. And with those transformations, they were better able to educate their children, particularly their daughters, as well as move from subsistence farming to really earning more than just a living wage. We helped to transform hundreds of cities globally and help them protect against the shocks and stresses of a more crisis-driven future. And I would say what I think I brought to it is that we always focused on how much impact we were having, not just how good we felt in funding the work or in doing this work. This was a very rigorous data-driven approach based on my training as an empirical scientist. And it was such a wonderful time. I loved the work. I loved my colleagues from around the world. And so importantly, it was such a privilege to have the opportunity to know firsthand and see firsthand our beneficiaries and really understand how much impact we were having on them.
Seneca's 100 Women to Hear will be back after this short break.
Well, it was certainly a very productive time for you and the foundation and what was happening. And, you know, you mentioned resilience, and I think the 100 Resilient Cities initiative was very visionary when you think of how vulnerable our cities are and how incredibly important resilience is. And the other term that always comes to mind during your tenure is impact investing, because it's obviously something we talk about a lot. I don't think a week goes by that I don't hear impact investing. But what does it really mean? And why do you think it has such resonance today?
Impact investing really means trying to create a double bottom line outcome, to produce a financial return, but also to produce a social or environmental return, and often both, so that you're having a triple bottom line outcome. And we came to this notion, again, in our early work consulting with experts and understanding the problems that the world was facing and working with colleagues at the UN in various State Departments where you were hard at work, the World Bank and others. And it was very clear to us that there simply was not enough money in philanthropy or in government aid globally, that all that money combined is billions of dollars. But that if we were going to unleash trillions of dollars, which is what we felt was necessary and what colleagues felt was necessary to solve the world's problems, and certainly that's how the SDGs G's were sized, then we needed to bring in the capital markets because that's where the trillions of dollars were. And so to solve problems like environmental degradation and climate change, to really solve problems like poverty and inequity. And so we hosted in 2007 a meeting at our Bellagio Center in Italy, and we brought some of the world's leading investors and some of the world's leading asset owners, pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, and the like. And they coined the term impact investing at that meeting.
Interesting.
And luckily, we recognized, we Rockefeller recognized that we could be, it wasn't only for us to invest money from our endowment in this type of investment, but that the field itself was still young, it was still fractured, and it was very much the domain of family offices or some small sets of private capital. And we wanted to unleash trillions. So we invested in about $60 million in actually building the architecture, the scaffolding of this field. We built the platforms that investors could share. We funded the development of all the metrics that were used early on to measure. Like we would hear from the financial sector, well, we know how to do diligence on the financial outcome, but we don't know how to do diligence on the impact outcome. What are the metrics? And interestingly, the metrics were really hard to find in ways that would be useful for the capital markets. So we invented those as well with several of our grantees. We worked with governments on the regulatory frameworks, particularly the EU and in the US on ERISA requirements, which could have limited the way pension funds could invest. So all of this infrastructure that we developed helped to really make this field grow and accelerate it. And I am so incredibly proud of my colleagues for recognizing that that was a role that we could play, particularly. And as a result of that, we were always at the table when these discussions occurred. And we helped then to foster this resonance, which now I think is everywhere, that you could link purpose and private, that you could do well and do good. And it really began to capture hearts and minds globally. And then, of course, we have to thank the millennials, because the millennials showed us that they don't want to work for companies that do bad things. They don't want to buy products that are done in bad ways, whether it's workers' rights being abrogated or environmental protections being abrogated. And so that, I think, has also helped in the last few years to really make this resonance transformational. And interestingly, there's now about $30 trillion of assets under management globally that would fall under this label of impact investing.
Wow, that's a lot of money. And it's true. It's a force today, impact investing, that is truly having transformative impacts. You know, you'd mentioned the capital markets and you've mentioned assets. And I'm very eager to talk about your latest book, which is Making Money Moral. What is moral money?
I would say that making money moral happens when the bold world of financial markets meets the aspirational world of impact. Because when that happens, you focus on capitalism benefiting more than just the shareholders. You know, last year we celebrated, or it was celebrated, the 50th anniversary of Milton Friedman's formative article suggesting that all companies ought to worry about are their shareholders. And I think moral money is part of a movement that recognizes that the financial markets have to be very, very mindful of all of the stakeholders, the consumers, the employees, the suppliers, the environment. The environment is a stakeholder in this new form of capitalism that we're really trying to make happen. And I think Making Money Moral is transforming our view of capitalism, because we've shown that the results can actually yield double the benefit, that they can drive both profitability and long-term growth because they reduce social and environmental risks, and they create value for society, really contributing to a more equitable and sustainable world.
So it's a win-win-win.
Totally.
Exactly how can investing in financial markets be used to address problems like climate change? You mentioned the environment. How does that work? Give us a little lesson.
Okay, and some good examples. But I credit climate change really with paving the way for the explosive growth of sustainable and impact investing. Because there was tremendous amount of innovation going on in finance, with a focus on efforts to protect the environment and to support the transition to renewable energy. And because of that, we saw the growth of environmental and climate-related and energy-protecting investing developing in every asset class, which we didn't expect when we coined the term impact investing. We thought that it would be an asset class all of its own. But now we see impact investing in venture capital, in private equity, in real estate investment trusts with social REITs. We see it in fixed income, where we have blue bonds and green bonds and resilience bonds and impact bonds, solar asset-backed securitization, all of these products now available. And in public equities, of course, as we see the, again, explosive growth of ESG and ESG-labeled funds in private equities. So if we just look at some of the earliest innovation, where you're creating new products and you're creating new markets, and you see this sort of flowering of collaboration. One example that we talk about in the book is Pension Denmark. It has $41 billion of assets under management, and they wanted to get into sustainable investment. And they partnered with the Danish energy company, now called Ørsted, but formerly known as the Danish Oil and Gas Company, to invest in renewable infrastructure, because Ørsted itself was embarking on a strategy to transform itself from a fossil fuel company to a clean energy company. And it was a win-win. They created a joint venture structure, which had a very innovative risk mitigation solution that really served each of their purposes. The two partners agreed to a profit-sharing agreement under which Pension Denmark could receive financial price support so that the fund would get a desired minimum return if the price of electricity dropped below a certain threshold. And they needed that certainty as a pension, and this allowed them to circumvent some of the risks that usually pensions aren't willing or able to do. In return, Ørsted received a larger share of the profits if the price increased above a certain level. Pension Denmark lent them money in the construction fund of all of their renewable energy plants, and it's led to hundreds of renewable energy projects in the last decade all over the world that have been invested in using this kind of model. I want to take one example, Milan, that's near and dear to our hearts, and that is, let's say an investor wants to focus on gender diversity or on improving life for women and girls around the world. So I say that investor has a very wide array of options now in both the public and private markets. One option would be a gender lens exchange traded fund known, I think, in the markets as an ETF. And it would be an ETF that invests in large global public companies that demonstrate effectiveness in promoting workforce gender diversity. One example is Women, WOMN. It tracks companies' performance using the Morningstar Women's Empowerment Index. And the fund manager donates his management fees and her management fees to the YWCA. So you get a sort of double benefit there. Another investor might be an angel funds investor. So very early stage companies using a gender lens in evaluating investments. And so that kind of investor would focus only on investing in early stage companies that have women founders. And so you could fulfill another part of your goal in that segment of the market. Private equity and venture capital funds offer opportunities through investments in companies that are developing products or developing services specifically for women and girls. For example, femtech, a whole range of critical health products. Finally, if an investor wants a fixed income product, she can choose government-issued social bonds, for example. There are many that focus on educating girls in the developing world and are set up as a bond-like structure with a fixed and stable return annually. So all across the market, you can really fulfill your goals depending on what your second bottom line really is.
Well, you've certainly whet my appetite to read the book. I can't wait to get my hands on Making Money Moral. This is fantastic. And I'm sure it's yet another contribution to the kind of impact you've been having. You did mention women's products in terms of social impact. And I want to ask you in the little time we have left about your perspective on women leaders. You've had so many extraordinary leadership roles in your life. Is women's leadership different? And how do we foster it?
I would say the data speak for themselves. Let's take responses to COVID, for example. As we look back, the evidence shows that women leaders across the globe acted earlier. They made greater use of science-based decision-making, and they communicated directly with their constituents earlier than most of their male counterparts. So that's across very different kinds of countries and very different types of women. There's this common core of what they did that differentiated themselves from many of their male counterparts. And I would say that we now have another great natural experiment in this period of recovery. We have three women, at least, in major global financial decision-making roles. The U.S. Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, Christine Lagarde leading the IMF, and now Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala leading the WTO. And I would say, again, that the world should watch out. We're going to see a lot of things done and done differently because these women are dynamos. They're collaborative, yet they're forceful, they're decisive, and they're compelling. So what can we do to teach women?
Yes.
Women need to be taught and rewarded for speaking up and speaking out. And we all know, we've all been in a room where we don't feel heard as women. And the comment doesn't gain resonance until a male makes it. You can be daunted by that, or you can speak up more and speak out and support one another to do that. Women need to develop actively the skills of resilience. It's not a genetic trait, it's a skill. And as you know, I write and talk about that so often. And that kind of skills training, I think, is critical. I think women need to find and use the right attributions when things go wrong. So there's a very well-known psychology experiment where something goes wrong and men and women are asked to explain what happened. And women will often make personal attributions. I didn't work hard enough. You know, I'm dumb. Whatever. And men will make external attributions. There was noise in the room, or that guy didn't cooperate, or whatever. And it's a very significant gender difference, and it starts quite early. We need women to look in the external environment for where they can make changes that can make the next failure, make them cope more readily with the next failure. And this attribution difference is often one of the critical variables. And then I think taking STEM training, whether or not you want to be a scientist, because I do think that building analytical thinking is very critical for women, particularly today, as the technology explosion is really transforming the way we act in the world.
So many good lessons. You know, you've made us a lot smarter in this conversation alone. This has been a tough time. The pandemic has created such dislocation and hardship, and we have so many challenges at home and overseas. What gives Judith Roden hope right now?
Vaccines and Joe Biden. Seriously, let's say that for me, vaccines are really a metaphor for the breakthroughs in science, which I just alluded to. We're witnessing a really explosive moment with the revolution that's going to be coming. We've seen now how we can use messenger RNA, and that's just the beginning. We're seeing how CRISPR can create a completely new world of gene editing. We're all talking about artificial intelligence and machine learning, and we're witnessing an explosion of technologies focused on climate change. I think, despite the deniers, that the pandemic and all the turmoil that we've been through in the last year really has shown us the existential risks of ignoring science. And it's interesting to me how many surveys are now showing that the overwhelming majority of people, given the year we've been through, really believe that. And that's very critical. And I say Joe Biden because it's so comforting to see and so important for us to be focusing again on everyday Americans and what they need to feel safe and prosper, not just on the moguls and the tycoons. To see that we'll rebuild our human and our physical infrastructure simultaneously, which is absolutely critical given the year we've been through. We will see again that facts and truth and transparency are part of the fundamental contract that we as leaders owe to our fellow Americans. And we're going to get ready for the next existential threat we will confront, and that is climate change. So I think given what we've been through, that we are at a critical inflection point. And I have to say, Milan, that I'm energized by the opportunity of this moment. And I'm thinking deeply about what I can do to contribute to another transformation. One more before I give up.
Well, you've certainly energized me, and I'm sure you've energized our audience listening to you, Judith. You are truly a game changer. And you're giving us this wonderful companion as you've piqued our interest in so many areas today, making money moral. So we'll have the book to read to continue to reflect on all of the kinds of things that you've talked to us about today. Thank you so much for this, for all you've done, and for all I know you will continue to do.
Thank you so very much.
That was truly invigorating. When it comes to big ideas, there's no one else like Judith Roden. Here are three things I took away from that conversation. First, as Dr. Roden tells us, partnerships are essential for change. When Penn wanted to help lift its disadvantaged neighborhood, the university saw to it that the schools were built, housing was improved, and economic development was fostered. But as she says, we did it together. We didn't do it for the community. We did it with the community. Second, with women leading so much of the world's economy, at the U.S. Treasury, at the IMF, and at the World Trade Organization, among others, we can look forward to some exciting days ahead. As Dr. Roden says, we're going to see a lot of things done and done differently. Because these women are dynamos. They're collaborative, yet they're forceful. They're decisive, and they're compelling. Finally, let's do as Dr. Roden encourages and take a fresh look at finance. Let's hold financial markets accountable for their actions and demand that they use our money to make the world a better place, a fairer place, a more sustainable place. And tune in next Thursday to hear about our next featured woman and discover why she's one of Seneca's 100 women to hear.
Seneca's 100 Women to Hear is a collaboration between the Seneca Women Podcast Network and iHeartRadio, with support from founding partner P&G. Have a great day.